Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, with the program that helps you learn and improve your American English skills. First, we will hear about a new book that examines conflicts in human and animal societies. Then, some information from the World Health Organization about something nearly all of us love to eat, but it has a good side and a bad side. Details follow in about 5 minutes. If you're ready, here is part one. When animals fight for mates, food, and territory, they use the weapons they were born with, teeth and claws, horns and hooves. Human animals can use their hands and feet, but they also fight with knives, guns, and bombs. A new book looks at the comparisons between human weapons and that of the animal world. Marcia James reports.
Insects fill the night with a low, continuous sound as two male stag beetles prepare to fight. They are competing for the interests of a female beetle. They battle with their mandibles, mouth parts that are pointy and sharp like the antlers of a deer. The stag beetle's mandibles can extend to half their body length. Doug Emlin is a scientist at University of Montana. He says that while animal weapons are common, extreme weapons like the beetles are not, and for good reason.
Just about every animal out there has some kind of a weapon. I mean, you can look at cats in your house, or dogs have claws, and eagles have talons. But when you look across animals, most of the time these weapons are pretty small. They're lightweight, they're portable, they don't slow you down, they're not very expensive to produce. But here and there, every now and then, we find these animal lineages where something has changed. And in these special species, the weapons start to get really big.
Doug Emlin explores these extremes in his new book, Animal Weapons, The Evolution of Battle. He says animals always evolve for a reason, such as ambushing or a surprise attack on their prey. Mr. Emlin says the ancient saber-toothed cat is an example. It had long, curved teeth that came to a sharp point well below the animal's lower jaw. The huge, heavy fangs made the cat slow and clumsy. So instead of chasing prey, it probably hid in trees to wait for prey. Then the cat would jump on the back of its victim and sink its fangs in for the kill.
These animals experience a very different pattern of selection. For them, it's not the overall running speed of their body or flying speed or swimming speed that matters, because they sit and they wait.
Another place where extreme weapons have developed is in termite colonies. Among these insects, the worker termites are small and quick. The soldier termites that guard the colony have very powerful jaws.
There are soldiers in these guys that can slice through a pencil.
Doug Emlin says most of these extreme weapons are on the male of the species. He adds that the most common driver of their development is battle. Like the elks that crash head-to-head with their huge antlers.
These are things that look like they should tip over or trip or get tangled up in branches if you're thinking about antlers on an elk.
Another animal that packs an extreme weapon is the very small fiddler crab. There can be thousands of them running around a single beach. Most of the males do so while waving a huge claw in the air.
Fiddler crabs actually are, as far as we know, the most extreme animal weapon anywhere. And in some of the most extreme cases, the biggest males of these fiddler crab populations produce a claw that is literally the entire weight of the rest of the body of the male.
The crab with the biggest claw almost always wins. Doug Emlin says the main point of the claw is communication to avoid battle, not win battle.
The males can go right up to an opponent, they wave their claws, they size each other up, and the smaller male walks away. And so this odd sort of paradox that arises in these animal species with these huge weapons is that a lot of times they hardly ever fight.
Doug Emlin says that in some ways, humans are no different. Size of weapons counts a lot in military services like the U.S. Navy.
Our aircraft carriers absolutely work as deterrents. There aren't any other countries that have navies as big as the one the United States has, for example, today, and we use those aircraft carriers as deterrents.
Doug Emlin says this is when human behavior moves in a very dangerous direction. He says our most powerful weapons are now widely available. He adds, if everyone has a nuclear bomb, how can enemies measure each other's strength and know when to surrender?
The cost of the weapons of mass destruction actually went down. They started making smaller and smaller warheads that could be packaged on smaller and lighter missiles.
Mr. Emlin says the number of warheads grew hugely. Now he says the problem is keeping watch on all of them. The biologist says there is no comparison in the animal kingdom for weapons of mass destruction. And those could destroy the world. So Doug Emlin says he hopes all nations will learn from the natural world. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The World Health Organization has released new dietary guidelines on sugar. The WHO says eating more than 50 grams of sugar a day can lead to weight gain, tooth troubles, and other diseases. Now the WHO is urging governments to take steps to limit how much sugar people eat. The World Health Organization says people around the world are eating more sugar. As a result, it says, health problems related to weight gain and tooth damage are increasing. Sugary foods and drinks cause tooth decay, weakening the bone. The WHO finds that, on average, the amount of sugar in the foods we eat has risen about 10% over the past 10 years. But it has risen at a faster rate in some areas. In the Middle East and North Africa, sugar intake has risen about 15% over the past 10 years. In some Asian and Pacific countries, sugar intake is 20% higher. And in South America, people eat more sugar than anywhere else in the world. Francesco Branca is director of the WHO's Department of Nutrition for Health.
In South America, we have approximately 130 grams per person per day, so more than twice the WHO recommendation. But we also have some parts of the world where the intake is still low. It is within the WHO recommendation, such as what is happening in Equatorial and Southern Africa, where it is about 30 grams per person per day.
Mr. Branca says reducing how much sugar you eat can be difficult because so many cooks and food makers add sugar. He says researchers found that 80% of the food items in U.S. markets included some kind of sugar.
Just to give you an example, an average size bowl of breakfast cereals contains 4 teaspoons of free sugars. If you go for a U.S. size can of soda, that contains 10 teaspoons of free sugars.
The WHO is calling on governments to take measures to reduce how much sugar people eat. It proposes taxing products with a lot of sugar and requiring food makers to list how much sugar can be found in their products. Another proposal is to restrict marketing of sugary foods and drinks to children. However, the United Nations agency says it is fine to eat foods that naturally have sugar, such as fresh fruits, vegetables, and even milk. I'm Jim Tedder.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Many people around the world leave their home country for a better education and better job in another country. A woman from Sri Lanka named Ashanti Mattai has a story like that. Ms. Mattai came to the United States from Sri Lanka in the early 1990s. She had a clear idea of what she wanted, a good education. Ms. Mattai went to Princeton University in New Jersey and got a degree in chemical engineering. She continued her education at Stanford Business School in California. Then she began her career in the healthcare industry. Now, Ms. Mattai has another goal, helping Sri Lanka. 4 years ago, Ashanti Mattai was visiting Sri Lanka for her job. During the trip, someone asked her if she would be willing to collect used eyeglasses in the United States. The donated glasses were to be used for a Sri Lankan program on preventing blindness. She learned there was a great need in Sri Lanka. She says many people in the country have vision problems that go untreated because of the high cost of eye care services. Ms. Mattai notes a 2012 study.
In Sri Lanka, 50% of the population live on less than $1.82 a day on average.
Eyeglasses can cost between $50 and $100 US. So they are out of reach to most of the population. But instead of recycling used glasses, Ms. Mattai took a different approach. Ashanti Mattai founded So Others May See, or SOMS, S-O-M-S. The nonprofit company helps people who need eye care in Sri Lanka. To date, SOMS has helped about 24,000 adults with eye exams and new eyeglasses. So Others May See also partners with Sri Lanka's Ministry of Health to provide free eye care for children. Dr. Asela Abadira is the ministry's spokesperson. He says the three-year-old partnership has created many successful programs. One program sends mobile health centers to schools across Sri Lanka to carry out eye examinations. The service has changed the lives of the 900,000 students examined so far. He says some children are able to see the world again. Ashanti Mattai says there is still more that needs to be done. She says she wants her nonprofit, SOMS, to treat more complex cases and to prevent vision problems. She says she is also planning to expand the service to another part of the population. She says she wants to include people who may not be very poor, but who still cannot afford to buy glasses. Ms. Mattai understands how poor eyesight can affect a person's life. She has used reading glasses from an early age. That poor eyesight has given her clearer insight on a world where everyone can see. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1890s, the American people were deeply divided over the nation's money system. Should the United States support its currency with gold or with gold and silver? The question became the main issue in the presidential election of 1896. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell the story of that election.
Many Americans wanted a gold standard. They said the United States should support its money only with gold. A gold standard, they said, would keep the value of the dollar high. These people were called gold bugs. Most were businessmen, bankers, and investors. Many other Americans wanted the United States to support its money with both gold and silver. They thought the value of the dollar was too high. A high dollar, they said, drove down prices for agricultural products. A silver standard would lower the value of the dollar. These people were called silverites. Most were farmers, laborers, and owners of small businesses.
The debate over gold and silver was especially important because of an economic depression that began in the United States in 1893. Thousands of banks and businesses closed. Millions of men lost their jobs. Foreign investors withdrew their money from America. Americans who had money were afraid to invest it. Many people believed the depression would end if the government issued more paper money backed by silver. President Grover Cleveland disagreed, and he opposed any legislation that might threaten the gold standard. He noted that every major nation supported its paper money with gold. The United States would be foolish, he said, not to do the same. It could not stand apart from the world's other money systems.
President Cleveland belonged to the Democratic Party. By 1896, many Democrats had become silverites. They gained control of party organizations in several western and southern states. They called Cleveland a traitor to his party and to the American people. They did not want him to be the party's candidate in that year's election. The Republican Party also was divided over the issue of gold and silver. Some members from silver mining states in the West left the party. Others remained in the party but gave support secretly to silverite Democrats. Republicans had done well in the congressional elections of 1894. They won control of both the Senate and House of Representatives. Party leaders were sure a Republican could be elected president in 1896. The most likely candidate appeared to be Governor William McKinley of Ohio.
McKinley was, in fact, nominated on the first ballot at the Republican convention in St. Louis, Missouri. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. The most likely candidate was Congressman Richard Bland of Missouri. A majority of convention delegates, however, were silverites, and they expected to nominate a silverite candidate. Supporters of President Cleveland wanted to test the silverites' strength. they demanded a debate on the gold-silver issue. Several men spoke in support of President Cleveland and the gold standard. Several spoke in support of silver. The last to speak was Congressman William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska. He had led an unsuccessful fight in Congress to keep America using silver.
Bryan spoke emotionally during the convention debate. He said he represented America's farmers, laborers, and small businessmen who wanted a silver standard. Bryan ended his speech with a line that became famous during the campaign. It called to mind the torture and death of Jesus Christ. Bryan said gold supporters could not force their money system on silver supporters. "You shall not," he said, "crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." With those words, William Jennings Bryan won the nomination away from Congressman Bland. He would be the Democrats' presidential candidate. He was just 36 years old.
A number of Democrats refused to accept Bryan as their candidate. They withdrew from the Chicago convention and held one of their own. They called themselves National Democrats. They nominated candidates for president and vice president, but they did not win many votes in the election. America's third party at that time, the People's Party, had a difficult decision to make. Populists, as they were called, agreed with silverite Democrats that the United States should have a silver standard. So some believed the party should unite with the Democrats to support Democratic candidate William Jennings Bryan. If they did not, Republican William McKinley was sure to win the election. Other populists feared that such a union would mean the end of the People's Party. The populists solved the problem at their nominating convention. Like the Democrats, they chose Bryan to be their candidate for president. But they chose a different candidate for vice president. In this way, William Jennings Bryan was able to run for president at the head of two separate political parties.
There was a great difference in the way the two presidential candidates campaigned. William McKinley refused to travel. Instead of going to the voters, he let the voters come to him, and they did. Railroad companies supported McKinley. They ran special trains to his home in Ohio. The trip was free. Each trip was the same. A band met the train and marched with the group to McKinley's home. McKinley came outside to hear a statement of support from the leader of the group. Then he made a short speech and shook hands. The group left, and another one came. On one day of the campaign, McKinley met 30 groups this way. That was more than 80,000 people.
While McKinley stayed at home, William Jennings Bryan traveled. He visited 27 states and spoke to 5 million people. Bryan explained that he had to travel because the Democratic Party did not have enough money to campaign in other ways. Bryan spent $650,000 on his campaign, McKinley spent $3.5 million. Bryan's main campaign idea was that the gold standard would ruin America's economy. McKinley's main campaign idea was that silver money would ruin the economy. For a time, Bryan's campaign seemed to be succeeding. More and more people promised to support him. Then, in the final weeks before Election Day, the situation began to change. The depressed economy showed signs of improving. The price of wheat rose for the first time in several years. Perhaps, people said, it was wrong to blame gold for the Depression. Perhaps, they said, the ideas of William Jennings Bryan were wrong.
On Election Day, it was soon clear who had won. McKinley received 270 electoral votes. Bryan received 176. Bryan congratulated McKinley. Then he told his supporters to begin getting ready for the next presidential election. "If we are right about silver," Bryan said, "we will win 4 years from now."
McKinley's election seemed to give new life to the American economy. Within a month, a business publication reported that buying and selling had increased greatly. It said demand for goods had led to the reopening of factories closed during the Depression. At the same time, new supplies of gold were discovered in Alaska, Australia, and South Africa. The extra gold increased the supply of money in the same way silver would have increased it. Taxes on imported goods rose to almost 60%. Under this protective tariff, American industry grew fast. The Depression ended.
The economic depression of the 1890s forced Americans to worry first about developments at home. But there were a number of international developments then which involved the United States. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.